listening to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Hi, this is Shane Vanderhart. Happy Wednesday. Welcome back to another episode. This week, we're continuing our look at different Iowa legislative races as we approach the Republican primary on June 5th. I had a conversation yesterday with John Van Wyk. He's a Republican candidate in a contested primary in Iowa House District 28, which is located just southeast of Des Moines, mainly in Marion County. But before we get to that conversation, first a word from our sponsors.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, Project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
Hi, this is Brian Myers. When I needed a better life insurance plan, I found it with Travis Riswold of Modern Woodmen of America. When I first met Travis, he wasn't like some other life insurance agents that can be pushy and try to get you to buy something. Travis just made himself available to me. That was it. He told me to let him know if and when I needed anything, and he stayed in touch. When the day came and I did need to make some changes with my life insurance, Travis met with me and walked me through several options so I could make an informed decision. Ultimately, it was the best decision for my situation. So if you need a life insurance plan that makes sense for you, call my friend Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen. His number is 515-883-0029. That's Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen. He can help you find the life insurance you need. Call him at 515-883-0029.
And I'm back. Without further ado, here's my conversation with John Van Wyk, Republican candidate in Iowa House District 28. Hey, John, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us. The first thing I want to ask you is that is a question that I ask every single candidate, regardless of the race they're running in, from president to state legislature. Why do you want to run?
Well, you know, I think that politics has become a spectator sport for many, and you see a lot of things going on, and you feel like you don't really have any control, or government has become so distant that I really want to get involved in the process. You know, I've got three kids, and I worry about their future, and rather than, you know, try to influence, you know, local legislators, I think by becoming one, I can have a more direct impact on the process and the future that we're going to lay out for them.
Great. So you're running in a contested primary in Iowa House District 28. I just wanted to ask you, you know, what sets you apart from any of the other candidate running, and if should you win the nomination, you know, for in the general election. So what qualifies you for the Iowa legislature?
Well, one of the challenges about being in a Republican primary is being able to distinguish yourself from your opponent, because, you know, theoretically you would be philosophically aligned in most areas, and how to distinguish yourself can be a challenge. But in the race for House District 28, I don't think it's actually that much of a challenge. You know, my opponent has worked for the state his entire adult life. He's unmarried, does not have any children. I'm not saying that those things are bad, but I really wonder what he brings to the table. And I think that when he looks at issues, because he's been a state trooper his whole life, every single thing that he looks at will be through the lens of law enforcement. Whereas myself, you know, I've been married for 20 years this month. My wife and I are raising three children in Sully. I've worked for county government. I was operations manager for the communications division at Story County Sheriff's Office for almost 5 years. So I've definitely had exposure to the public safety side of things, but I've also worked in the private sector and am a small business owner today. So, you know, having a family, raising a family, and having a broader background, I think I bring a lot more to the table in being able to have a diverse perspective on the various issues that will come up in the legislature.
Okay. Well, the legislature just passed the fetal heartbeat abortion ban. And, you know, looking at the life issue, is that something you would have been able to vote for? Did it go far enough? Or do you think, you know, the legislature is all done with this issue and it's time to move on?
Well, I would start off by saying I definitely supported the heartbeat bill. I don't think it goes far enough, but I think it's an excellent first step.
Right.
One of the challenges in modern times is, of course, having Roe v. Wade being an obstacle to any sort of legislation that you pass that does restrict access to abortions. And so, you know, we need to be shrewd in the way we approach the issue. Is that to say that we should stop there? Of course not. But I think that this bill was an excellent first step because it's written in such a way that it should be able to hold up against judicial scrutiny. And I think it's the sort of thing where we want a lawsuit. That way we can overturn Roe v. Wade. The abortion issue at this point is more so in the courts than it is in the legislative hands. And so we have to get the issue back into the courts in such a way that we can, you know, get that bad law and precedent overturned. Unfortunately, we have a Democrat attorney general who has said that he's not going to defend it, and that's very disappointing, and hopefully Iowa voters will do what they can to remedy that, you know, come November.
It amazes me that we have an attorney general who says he won't defend our law. That's incredible.
Well, it's not something that should necessarily surprise us these days.
You right.
know, when you have a Democrat that they're more interested in politics than they are the rule of law, even if they are, you know, whether they're sitting on the bench or, you know, being a prosecutor. We need to return to a republic format where the rule of law is followed, even if you don't agree with it.
Right. And, well, one of the big issues that the state legislature deals with would be education. It takes up the largest share of the state budget, about 57%, which includes K-12 funding, community colleges, regional universities, 57% of the general fund. And obviously that doesn't even include money raised in with property taxes at the local level. With education being such a big part of the state political picture, how do you define what local control in education means? What would that look like for you?
Well, I think education, like most things that are run by government, are best done as local as possible. The further away the control is over a process, and the more bureaucratic it becomes, the less control the actual individual voter has over the process. So, you know, I think that public education is, of course, important because, you know, we all benefit from an educated society. But we also need to understand that whenever you put government in total control of something, it necessarily becomes less efficient and it costs more. So we need to look at ways of being able to achieve that, but also in a more competitive environment, because the free market does its job very well. It does things more efficiently. It does it at less cost. It provides a better product. And that's not to say that we should, you know, completely get rid of public education. That's not what I'm saying.
Right.
But we need to make it easier for families who have children in school to have more school choice, be it at different public schools or at a private school. And of course, you have the community that does homeschooling as well. I mean, they're paying property taxes. I mean, even if you're a renter, you know, that property tax that your landlord has is calculated into your rent.
Right.
And so we need to make, I don't know the exact percentage. I think that it's somewhere around, you know, 40 or 50% of your property tax goes to public education. And if I have a kid in school and I want to send them to a private school, I think that, you know, maybe I should be able to apply the portion of my property taxes or the portion of my rent that goes to my landlord's property taxes to the school of my choice. Now, that's not to say that should replace a voucher system, but maybe in addition to it. But Whenever we have a government monopoly, we don't get the service that we're paying for.
Right.
How to exactly achieve that is, of course, debatable. But one of the things that we need to look at, and one of the things that we constantly hear, is that we don't fund education enough. The left likes to say that a lot.
Right.
And my question is, if we spend 300 to 400% per child more than other industrialized nations, yet our test scores are subpar compared to those industrialized nations, where are we going wrong? Where is our money not efficiently being spent? And like I said, in our environment, the more layers of government bureaucracy that you have, the less that end user is getting those funds. So for every dollar that we increase the budget for education, how much of that dollar is going towards hiring better teachers and providing better supplies for our children that are actually in there? And how much of that is going to elaborate, you know, school buildings and paying for administrators and the various levels of bureaucracy that accompanies that? So I don't know that it necessarily means we need to raise the amount of money that we're spending on education, but take what we're already spending and spend it a heck of a lot more efficiently than we already are.
Right. Well, you kind of took the wind out of my sails. That was kind of my next question about your view on education spending. I think you addressed that well. Returning back to the idea of local control in education, what's your view of the Common Core State Standards, Next Generation Science Standards, and top-down standards like that that Iowa has adopted and aligned our standards to? Do you oppose them? Do you support them? Why not?
Well, so Common Core is something that my wife and I have started to get, of course, firsthand exposure to. I have a 13-year-old and an 11-year-old and a 7-year-old. And so, you know, as we try to help our children with homework and we see the format of the homework that they're trying to do, I just sometimes scratch my head and I'm thinking, what on earth are they trying to accomplish here? This is not the way, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic should happen. You know, some of the questions they have on my son's math homework, you know, I consider myself to be a reasonably educated person. You know, I went to college, I went to graduate school, and when I look at a problem that's on a seventh grade homework, and I'm not even sure what the question is asking because it's so convoluted and so far away from the education that I received when I was my son's age. You know, if I could actually figure out what they're asking, I'm sure I could come up with a solution to the problem. But
right.
I can't even put my finger on what's wrong with the Common Core because it's just so, I don't even know how to say it. It's so far away from what we should be teaching our children and just the logic. It's missing all logic in the way it's constructed. And I think that any parent out there that is in a similar situation can definitely agree with me and relate.
Okay, so if you were elected to the state legislature, would you support a bill repealing Common Core from our state standards?
Well, you know, we use terms to define things, you know, Common Core, whatever that means. I think we need to have standards. But, you know, I remember back when I was going through grade school, you would take an Iowa Basic Skills test. We had testing, you know, for the longest I can remember, and I'm sure
right.
that my parents had testing. But I think that when we could create a scenario where teachers can't teach our children because we are all worried about passing tests. Testing is important, of course, to benchmark the progress of your child's education, but I wonder how much it's actually hampering actual learning.
Right.
And critical thinking skills.
Yeah.
So I think that we need to take a look at what have we done over the past several years that's working, take a look at what's not working, and replace what's not working.
Okay. Moving on to, you know, the legislature took up a constitutional amendment to affirm in the Iowa Constitution Iowans' right to keep and bear arms. That passed in the Iowa Senate. It didn't pass in, or excuse me, it did pass. I'm sorry, it did pass in the Iowa House too. It needs to pass again next General Assembly before it can go before voters. Is that something that you support?
Well, let me start off by saying that you're not going to find more pro Second Amendment or more right to bear arms candidate than my candidacy. The reason I say that is my first real foray into firearms was when I was an infantryman with the U.S. Marines. And so I have a more fundamental understanding of how firearms work, what distinguishes one firearm from the next. I'm also an NRA certified range safety officer, and I work over at, I volunteer at Brownell's Big Spring Shooting Complex in that capacity. So when I look at gun laws through the lens of an experienced shooter who understands the nuances between gun features and things like that, I understand what Democrats are trying to do when they pass certain laws and chip away at those rights. And more we're seeing the left attack gun rights at the state level. They've gotten no traction at the federal level. And so they're starting with all the blue states where they know they got low-hanging fruit. And then they're trying to turn red states into purple and blue states so that they can do the same thing here. So, you know, we've made a lot of progress on gun rights in Iowa over the past few years, from going to shall issue to legalizing suppressors and allowing parents to teach their children firearm safety with pistols and so on and so forth. And if you think that, rather if anyone thinks that we can just rest easy, that Iowa's, you know, a totally pro-gun state, you know, these things can turn on a dime. The legislature could turn over to Democrats in the future, and we need to make sure that we have protections in place at the state level that will prevent rolling back these laws and take, you know, taking away additional gun rights. You know, some people will say, well, we already have the Second Amendment. Why do we need to enshrine the right to bear arms in the Iowa Constitution? Well, we can see how, you know, activist judges and the left twist the words the Second Amendment, you know, written in, you know, 18th, 19th century English to mean whatever they want it to mean. And so by putting it in the Iowa Constitution using modern language, it will make it much more difficult for those activist judges to twist the meanings of our words and take our rights away. So I think it's very important. And if elected to the state legislature, I will most definitely vote for that when it comes up again next year.
Excellent. Moving on to taxes, the Iowa legislature just passed a tax reform package right before they adjourned for the session. Does that tax reform package go far enough? And what does the ideal tax reform package, tax relief package look like to you?
Well, you know, when it comes to taxes and how much should we pay, I think that it really comes back to the root of what's the role of government. If we can get to the foundation of what the role of government is, as originally intended by their founders who formed our republic, I think that we can really understand how much government has grown out of control. And so when we say, let's pass this tax cut or that tax cut, the left will say, well, how are you going to pay for that tax cut? Well, before you can be have a net neutral attitude on not, you know, having a balanced budget and when you do pass tax cuts, we can first define what the narrow role of government should be and shrink government to the size that fits that definition. Then we can start having a conversation about what the appropriate level of taxes is. But it seems like we got the tail wagging the dog here, where we've got this big giant elephant in the room, and nobody wants to have the conversation about out-of-control spending on a government that's way larger than it was ever intended to be.
Right. So how would how would you address limiting state spending? Because I agree, our revenue is not kept up at the level of spending that our state has done. How do you rein that in?
Well, I think we have a lot of government solutions where we should have free market solutions. You know, wherever you have government doing, there's a certainly appropriate roles of government. Infrastructure, public safety, be it the police, law enforcement, fire, ambulance services, stuff like that. Things that we cannot do for ourselves and we need to have as a community service. But there are certainly other things that government has injected itself into over the past decades that really would be much more efficiently and better served in the private sector. So we need to go through and just look at the government in general and look at the budget in general and say, where are areas that government is currently trying to do things that the private sector would be more efficient to do, and then take a smaller role in those areas and try to actually get ourselves out of the business of doing things that we should be able to do ourselves.
Okay.
And then once you do that, you can start looking at how to shrink back the taxes so that it's more appropriate in line with what the government actually needs.
Do you think the state government should adopt zero-based budgeting where it can?
When you say zero-based budgeting, are you talking about where if you cut taxes in over here, then you have to shrink the budget over there?
Well, no, I mean, it just seems like most government just approaches budgeting from, hey, this is where we were at last year, and that's our starting point, rather than, hey, justify your budget, you know, completely start from zero, and let's build it from there. Because it seems like, I think that's one of the reasons why our budget grows year after year. I mean, we don't approach family budgeting that way. We all pretty much start from a zero-based budget, and our budget is based on our income. It doesn't seem that's the approach of state government.
Yeah, I think we can get closer to that, certainly. Like I said, I worked in county government for almost 5 years and was involved in establishing the budget for the communications division. And I would say that in that environment, they were always looking for a 5% increase. And I found that confusing to myself, quite frankly, because it's like, are we looking to increase the number of services that we provide, or are we just trying to have a cost of living adjustment, sort of inflation sort of thing, where mm-hmm. you know the price of gas has gone up, so we need to have a larger gas budget for patrol cars, that sort of thing. And I would say that if you've, like in my earlier answer, have narrowly defined what the role of government is and then come up with a budget that is appropriate to that role, at that point, you should be able to just say, we will increase the budget by whatever the inflation index is. So if inflation has gone up 2%, then we should be able to say it's reasonable to assume that everything that we, all the services that we're providing will cost 2% more. And then, you know, increase the budget accordingly. But that's not the way it works. And it seems like we're always trying to increase the number of programs that we have. And the more programs that we have, the more control we have over people that, you know, depend on those programs. So,
right.
I mean, I really think that we can get closer to what you're saying. But we also have to understand that public budgeting is a very complex mechanism that you don't want to start from scratch every single year. You'll spend the entire year establishing your budget.
Right. That's obviously true. I mean, some budgets, some programs you can do that. School finance, for instance, you wouldn't be able to do that. We wouldn't be able to do that with Medicaid, Medicare.
Well, not to mention a lot of the programs that you do provide services for are not based on a one-year plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might have an initiative that you have a five-year plan for. So it'd be difficult to establish a five-year plan if you don't even know what your budget for that will be on the following subsequent years. So
good point. Just one area of the budget that seems to be pretty significant, that's property tax backfilling that the state legislature added when they did property tax reform. Some counties and municipalities need it. Others seem like they're doing just fine. They would be doing fine without it, and their property tax base has grown. Does the state legislature need to take a look at that and maybe revisit it and rework it next session?
You know, as a homeowner, one of the things that, you know, I remember back when we had the housing crisis, you know, back in the 2008 era, and you would read stories about, a retired couple that they own their home, but they come under a situation where they're strapped financially and they get behind on their property taxes. And then you get a situation where the government then confiscates their home. So it seems like property taxes in general are not the way I would approach paying for the things that property taxes pay for.
Okay.
The reason I say that is because it seems like, you know, as the saying goes, you're still paying rent to the king.
Right.
It almost prevents your ability to actually own the property that you're on, because if you don't pay rent to the king, the king's going to take your land away from you. And so it almost, from my perspective, the way property taxes are structured and the way the government has total control over your property if you're unable to pay them for whatever reason, it just seems like there's other ways that we should approach our tax scheme that doesn't rely so heavily on property taxes. Now, that's a very complicated answer, because your next question will be, well, how would you approach the tax? Anyway, if we were to diminish or get rid of property taxes, how do you pay for everything that property taxes used to pay for?
Right.
And that's, of course, a very complicated thing as well. But I'm a proponent of consumption tax.
Okay.
You know, if we could get rid of income tax, get rid of property tax, and make everything a consumption tax, I that's my preferred way, because not to mention it makes it a lot easier to save for retirement. You know, if the income that I make is not siphoned off by the government and I'm able to save 100% of whatever I set aside,
mm-hmm.
I think that makes a lot more sense. And then we will rely less on Social Security when we get older, because we were put in a position where we were able to save more efficiently over the course of, you know, 30 years.
Okay. Just wanted to ask you really quickly about religious liberty. Obviously, there will be a Supreme Court case that's the decision will come out as I can't remember the name of the cake shop, Masterpiece Cake Shop, the Colorado mm-hmm. Civil Rights Commission. Supreme Court heard oral arguments already, so they'll be making a decision this summer. But the legislature this session had, in both in the House and in the Iowa Senate, had Religious Freedom Restoration Acts that would have provided some relief, for at least a way of legal defense for those who are accused of discriminating against somebody because, say, well, in the case of Gort's House is probably the best known example in Iowa. They had LGBT customers who would come in, you know, eat lunch or buy flowers there, but they didn't want to rent out their facility for a same-sex, you know, wedding ceremony, and therefore had a complaint filed against them, and the state found against them, and they had to pay a settlement. How do we protect Iowans in situations like that? You know, obviously discrimination's not good, and we don't want to do that, but yet we also have to understand that, you know, there are times where Iowans need to be able to, you know, exercise a right to conscience. And it seems like right now, the way things are set up, that's not a possibility. So how should the state protect Iowans' religious freedom and right to conscience?
Well, of course, that's also a complicated question. As the libertarian in me says, I leave you alone, you leave me alone, and as long as whatever I'm doing doesn't negatively affect you and vice versa, everybody should be happy.
Right.
But where that balance is and where that line is at, where what I'm doing affects you or vice versa, I think that the state has difficulty judging where that line is at. You know, as a co-owner of a winery in Sully, my family and I have had these questions. You know, we see a baker getting sued, and there was also, I think, actually in Iowa, there was a wedding venue. A couple had dressed up a barn, and that barn was used as a wedding venue. I think it was in Iowa, but I may be wrong. But nevertheless, that person did not want to host a same-sex marriage in their barn, and they were sued, and they just determined that they're no longer going to do weddings.
Yeah.
And so, you know, our family struggles with the same question. If a same-sex couple wanted to have a wedding at the winery, what would we do? And
is that something
you don't
you guys
want to be
do?
In a position where you put your business at risk, your reputation at risk.
Mm-hmm.
Really, but at the same rate, you want to live by your own convictions.
Right.
And so I think it's important for the state to recognize that you have a First Amendment right, and your First Amendment right of free speech and having control over your own business is important. And now, one of the things that I also think people should recognize is that just because you may not want to, like, let me give you an example. My wife is an artist. She does portraits, mm-hmm. oil on canvas, that sort of thing. And if a same-sex couple were to come approach her and say, "We want you to paint a picture of us in our, you know, in our wedding garb," if she were to refuse, you know, at what point do you get to a point where you have a same-sex couple demanding your time and your labor and your treasure to do something for them that you don't want to do?
Oh, and your expression, so, your artistic expression in that case, I mean, that's clearly a First Amendment. You know, this is coerced speech. You're forcing me to, and that's one of the arguments made in the masterpiece cake shop case, is that you're forcing me to use my artistic expression to celebrate something I vehemently disagree with.
Yeah, and so you end up being faced with either the option of going against your core beliefs or shutting down your business. I mean, that's essentially what your two options are, short of violating whatever edict the leftist court determines, and then you end up, you know, losing your business anyway because you get sued for everything that you own. So, and I think that we can very easily connect the dots on all of these cases that we see around the nation. This is not a situation where you have same-sex couples going to a business and just being maltreated. What we have are same-sex couples that are targeting businesses. They're right. Going somewhere where they know that they're going to have an issue because they want to be having an issue because they want to have a lawsuit. I mean, if they're going to try to tell me that they couldn't find any other baker to bake them a cake,
right?
I mean, that's just not realistic.
Or another venue or whatnot. Yeah, yeah.
Or another venue. Yeah.
Well, hey, one last question. I'll let you go because we're going on a half hour here. Where can people learn more about your campaign? And is there anything that we haven't discussed that you want to make sure our listeners are aware of?
Well, like I said earlier in the conversation, I feel like I bring a lot to the table with a diverse background and, you know, from being a small business owner, working in the public and private sectors, and being able to approach any legislative issue from a perspective that's more broad than what my opponent offers. Another thing that I will always rest assured and everybody can know is I will be accessible. You know, I publish my cell phone number. People can email me, they can Facebook me, and I respond. And that's not just something I would do as a candidate. As a legislator, I would be accessible. And I want to hear what the residents and voters of House District 28 want. Because at the end of the day, I'm not representing the Republican Party. I'm not representing the whole state of Iowa. I'm representing a single district. And like I said earlier, the more local our government is, the more accountable it is to the voters that put us there. And that's what I want to be. I want to be an accountable legislator that hears the concerns of residents of District 28 and takes it to the legislature and turns that into good law. And you can go to my website at vanwyk4iowa.com, all spelled out. And then, I'm also available on Facebook. And I encourage people to go there and like that page. And they'll be able to see in their newsfeed different things that we're doing around the district and see the positions that we have.
All right. Well, hey, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. And best of luck to you.
Yeah, thanks for the interview.
That concludes today's episode of the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, please be sure to check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. That's caffeinatedthoughts.com, or you can just Google Caffeinated Thoughts and it'll show up at the top of your search screen. Also, be sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our email updates. That way you don't miss a single article. Hey, until next time, my friends, this is Shane Vanderhart. Take care.